Well, we welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals on our opening day for the fiscal year 2014. We're glad to have you all here. We have only two cases on our docket, and we will proceed through both of them unless we take just a really short recess. The first case is Columbia Medical Center versus DFW Supergroup, and if the clerk will please announce counsel, he'll be arguing. All right, thank you. All right, Mr. Hood.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Hood with the law firm of Haynes & Boone. I represent the appellant, Denton Regional Medical Center. May it please the court. The court should reverse the trial court's judgment for one of six independent reasons. The case arises out of a lease between the hospital as the landlord and DFW as the tenant. DFW was operating a medical clinic in a strip shopping center. The DFW had two managers, Dr. Burstford, who was the medical director, and Ms. Lena Ralston, who was in charge of staffing. Now, the hospital got entangled with a dispute between these two partners that ended up DFW suing the hospital and Dr. Burstford. On a motion for summary judgment, the hospital succeeded in having all but two of the claims dismissed. The only two claims against the hospital that went forward to trial were claims sounding in indemnification and breach of covenant of quiet enjoyment. At the trial court severed all of Dr. Burstford's claims and at directed verdict ruled that the indemnification claim was subject to directed verdict. So there was only one claim that DFW had that proceeded to the jury, and that was the claim on the breach of covenant of quiet enjoyment. The jury found that the hospital had breached the covenant of quiet enjoyment claim, and that there were damages of $100,000 in lost profits. The court ruled on the attorney's fees issue and gave DFW $110,000 in attorney's fees and gave the hospital approximately $39,000. The hospital filed a motion for JNOV as well as a motion for new trial, both of which were denied. The hospital appealed, DFW did not. The first issue is that the trial court erred by entering judgment for DFW on a breach of implied covenant of quiet enjoyment claim because there is a lease in this case and it's undisputed that the lease contains an express covenant of quiet enjoyment. And under Texas law, you can't have an implied covenant when there is an express covenant. And we cite in the brief the Texas law that supports that. Now, it appears that DFW doesn't dispute that. DFW's response brief says that the jury was asked a question on the express covenant of quiet enjoyment. That's paragraph 21.8 of the lease. That the hospital is mischaracterizing the jury question as an implied covenant, and that there was sufficient evidence to support a jury finding a breach of the express covenant. So we appear to be two ships passing in the night here on what the jury question was. Our position is the jury question was a question on the implied covenant of quiet enjoyment. The language of question one refers to the implied covenant and asks if the hospital breached it. And the rule in this court is that a jury question is to be construed according to the ordinary import of the words used. Now, of course, the jury question did not happen in a vacuum. It was DFW that urged the court to find that in its petition it had pled an implied covenant of quiet enjoyment. It is DFW that asked the judge to allow them to submit this question on implied covenant of quiet enjoyment. They're the ones that did submit the question. They did not object to the question. And in the absence of an objection, DFW is bound by the statements of law contained in the submitted jury charge. DFW counsel, in his closing argument, read jury question number one to the jury and emphasized that it was an implied covenant. So bottom line, DFW is restricted in this appellate court to the theory that was tried in the lower court.
And can I ask a question here? Was question number one submitted in this format by DFW?
Yes, ma'am. Right, in the jury.
You had an objection at trial to question number one as well.
We did.
Okay.
We did.
What was your objection?
Okay. Well, we had the objection. DFW did not.
Okay.
And our objection was a no evidence objection.
Okay.
Now, the judge's rulings during the trial made clear that he was only allowing DFW to present a question relating to implied covenant. But I think it's important to emphasize that it was DFW that came in at trial and said, we have an implied covenant claim and let us bring that. The judge had some concerns about whether DFW still had an express covenant claim, and it was DFW that said, let us bring our implied covenant. And the trial judge allowed that. But this court should reverse because under Texas law, it was an error to enter a judgment when there was an express covenant in this case. Now, we also have a grounds for appeal that it was an error because DFW did not show that it met the elements of a breach of quiet enjoyment claim. It requires an abandonment or an actual eviction or a constructive eviction. There was no abandonment in this case. There was no actual eviction. So all they had was to show constructive eviction. And they did not meet the elements of constructive eviction. Ms. Ralston testified that the clinic was continuously in use. And for that reason, they could not meet the elements of their quiet enjoyment claim. And by the way, those elements apply whether we're talking about an express or an implied. And it's all across the Texas cases. It's not unique to some certain unjust enrichment fact scenario. We cited cases in our brief where the tenant remained in the premises, the tenant remained current on rent, but the court still applied this constructive eviction elements in order to show that that claim exists. DFW argues that the hospital did not preserve its appeal. It did not preserve error. And I just want to note that we are appealing on the grounds that not a jury charge error, but that it was error to enter the judgment when, under the facts of this case, with that express covenant, the question related to whether the hospital breached an implied covenant. And the hospital preserved error in two ways. One, the hospital did file the motion for JNOV, objecting to the implied covenant question. And under the Texas Supreme Court case Holland that we cite in our brief, a JNOV motion preserves error on the issue of, in that case, a statutory bar to the recovery of attorney's fees. The hospital also preserved error by objecting, making the no evidence objection at the time of submission of the jury question. And we cite in our brief the Texas Supreme Court case Gonzalez versus Olshan Foundation, where a no evidence objection to a jury question was held sufficient. In that case, it related to an implied warranty, and that objection was sufficient to preserve the argument that express warranty superseded the implied warranty. The next grounds for the appeal is the trial court erred by failing to exclude evidence that DFW presented based on DFW's failure to comply with discovery. What happened here was about 60 days before trial, DFW amends its disclosures to say they're seeking $50,000 a month in lost profits. About 2 days before trial, DFW amends its disclosure to say the method that they used to calculate those lost profits. The hospital moved at trial to exclude DFW from presenting evidence of their lost profits because it was an inadequate disclosure. And the trial court, and we believe this was an error, the trial court said, hospital, you waived your objection to adequacy because you didn't file a motion to compel. And we argued, and we argue here today, that Rule 194 requires an adequate disclosure of not only the amount of damages, but the method for calculating those damages. And that was not done in this case. And the second thing is that Rule 193 provides for automatic exclusion. And that was not done in this case. Instead, what the trial court did is say, look, I'm going to let DFW present evidence of $50,000 a month lost profits, but they can't present evidence of how they calculated that. So at trial, Ms. Ralston testified that DFW incurred lost profit damages of $50,000, and that was all that she submitted. But again, we rely on the rules, the comment to the rules, the cases from this court that have all held that inadequate disclosure should have resulted in an automatic exclusion. Now, DFW doesn't really appear to contest that. They first of all argue that the Transamerica case is the appropriate standard. We believe that's misplaced because that case is 9 years prior to the enactment of those rules. And the second thing that DFW argues is they say, well, it was harmless error because there was other evidence that came in to establish $50,000 a month lost profits, and they refer to an exhibit, Plaintiff's Exhibit 20, which was a spreadsheet of the clinic's income and expenses for a 16-month period, both before, during, and after the dispute with the hospital. And they argue that this is cumulative. And our response is it's not cumulative. It doesn't show lost profits. There was no testimony at trial that was used to establish lost profits. It doesn't say they're lost profits. And most importantly, the spreadsheet doesn't provide that benchmark that you have to use to compare the but-for. You know, what would have been their profits but-for the hospital's alleged actions? There's no way to use that spreadsheet to come up with the lost profits. So it's not cumulative. And also, we don't believe the jury would have used that spreadsheet. And if they did, it would be so contrary to the great weight of the evidence. It doesn't have the benchmark. It doesn't show $50,000 in lost profits. In fact, this hospital had about $10,000 loss every month, both before, during, and after the situation with the hospital. So you can't make that you can't link A to B by using that spreadsheet. So it's not cumulative, and even if the jury did use it, it would be against the great weight of the evidence. And we cite in our brief the American Hat case, for American Hat versus Wise Electric. It was this court where the plaintiff had market value damages, and they argued that the jury could have relied on a 2005 tax appraisal of inventory to reach those damages. And this court said, we've looked at that document. You can't make it from A to B. It's not sufficient. If the jury relied on that, it would have been against the overwhelming weight of the evidence. Same thing here. The spreadsheet of the income and expenses does not get you to that lost profit.
Now, you said that one of the parties did not testify to the source of Exhibit 20. Is that correct? So
yeah,
how was it admitted, even?
It was admitted as a spreadsheet of income and expenses, but there was no testimony to say that this was used to derive the $50,000 in lost profits. The only evidence of $50,000 lost profits is Ms. Ralston saying, we incurred $50,000 lost profit a month, and that's all that she testified to. Key issue on damages, and probably caused the rendition of an improper judgment, because it probably caused this jury to find that for the 2 months Dr. Burstford had a key, there were $50,000 lost profits each month. That's how they came up with the $100,000. So we definitely believe that the admission of that evidence constitutes harmful error. And then there's Texas Supreme Court case that a party seeking recovery for lost profits must prove those profits with reasonable certainty. Has to be objective facts, figures, no speculation. Under the Holt-Atherton case we cite, you have to provide an indication of how you came up with your lost profits. And in Holt-Atherton, the plaintiffs said, well, we had $200,000 in lost profits. And the Texas Supreme Court said, that's not good enough. You haven't shown us the indication of how you got it. Same here, same thing here. Ms. Ralston testifying we had $50,000 in lost profits isn't enough to establish or indicate how they arrived at that. So that's another ground for reversing the trial. And then finally, on the attorney's fees, if the court reverses the judgment, the fees to DFW becomes a moot point. But otherwise, if they prevailed on a common law breach of implied, common law breach of quiet enjoyment, then they did not establish what was required under the lease was that you had to prevail under a lease under the claim. So they didn't establish that. And the trial judge used that standard on us. They gave the hospital $39,000 in attorney's fees because we prevailed at summary judgment on the breach of the lease claims. But when we prevailed at the directed verdict on the common law indemnification, the trial court said, no, I'm not giving you that because that doesn't fit the contours of the lease. But inexplicably for DFW, they gave DFW all their fees that they were asking for, even though they did not establish that they were claims under the lease. And we asked them in trial to segregate, and the judge shut us down. But we preserved error in our motion for new trial on that issue. I see I've run out of time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hood. Mr. Toops?
May it please the court. I'm David Toops, and I represent DFW Supergroup 2 LLC, the appellee and the trial court plaintiff in this particular matter. And in my time before the court this afternoon, I'm going to show that Judge D. Shipman and the Denton County jury made the right call in ruling in favor of DFW Supergroup. We asked the court to affirm the trial court's rulings and the judgment and the jury findings. Before I begin discussing the case this afternoon, I would like to point out three clarifications. First, DFW's claim was for a breach of contract, not an implied covenant of peaceful enjoyment. The only thing that was on the plate when the court went forward at trial with the jury was a breach of contract claim or a violation of the express warranty of peaceful enjoyment, the express covenant of quiet enjoyment. That's what the evidence was presented.
How do you respond to the argument about question number one, then making an inquiry to the jury about the implied covenant?
Well, thank you, Your Honor. You go right to the point, my second point. The other clarification I was going to make is there's a differentiation between a question and a jury instruction. The jury instruction references the covenant, the implied covenant of quiet enjoyment. That's the jury instruction. The jury question makes no such delineation at all. And further, what occurred.
But the instruction is not in the instruction part of the charge. It's immediately before the question. And it says there is an implied covenant in favor of the tenant that the tenant will have peaceful and quiet enjoyment of the premises. Did the hospital breach the covenant of peaceful and quiet enjoyment? How can that not be referring to an implied covenant?
The instruction is referring to an implied covenant. There's no doubt about that. And we don't contest that. That the instruction states exactly that. But the jury also had before it, without objection, the actual contract itself, which had the express warranty of quiet enjoyment. Also, at the trial court, the jury came back with a note asking for further clarification. Once more, further instruction went back to the jury on question number one regarding that matter without an objection. So I don't deny that the implied warranty instruction was error. But there's no way it would be reversible, and there would be no way that it would, nor was it preserved on either point.
Well, I think that we're not having a meeting of the minds as to what constitutes an instruction and what constitutes a question, because, you know, in the jury charge, the instruction portions and the definition portions are at the front, and then you have question one, and then you have the language that you're saying is an instruction. But it's under question one, and then we have the actual question, and then the jury blank. So it's your position that the language listed under question one is an instruction?
No, there's a question on question one, which is followed by a question mark. There's a statement preceding that, which is an instruction.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. The other, you just cleared my second point. The third point that I would like to clarify, so that way we're all on the same ground, is trial court comments are interpreted all throughout the appellant's brief, where he is indicating random statements by the judge as being rulings, some of which are actually go directly contrary to the order granting partial summary judgment. And then in the reply brief, they even go further and say that, no, when we point this out, they said the court was not reversing its ruling, it was clarifying its ruling, although the position that they're taking is directly contrary to the express language of the order that the judge had signed, indicating that the contractual claim for quiet enjoyment remained, and he had specifically denied summary judgment on that point. So we go back first to the express versus implied question. Under Rule 301 of the Texas Rules of Procedure, the trial court is supposed to enter a judgment that represents the pleadings that were before the court, the evidence that was introduced, and the judgment and the verdict of the jury. The court had to do what it did in rendering the judgment it did, because those were the things that came in. The appellant even talks in his brief and admits that the evidence that came in at trial and much of the testimony regarded the express covenant, and that's what was going on. Not until the jury charge conference did these statements made by the judge become what they said were rulings. The trial court's judgment itself doesn't support what they're asserting that this judge was doing. Matter of fact, the court even awards attorney's fees, which was brought up earlier, and the only way that you would get attorney's fees is if you had a contract claim.
I have another question.
Yes, Your Honor.
How is the express covenant in the contract here any different from the implied covenant?
That's a very good question, because the way I saw it, there's really not. That's why it would not be reversible. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the jury, the instruction that was part of question one, the jury had the express right there. There's no differentiation between the two. And further, in this particular matter, it was the appellant's burden to point out exactly the question you're asking, is how is this harmful? How is this harmful error? How is this reversible error?
Well, it does look like in the case law, recognizing that you do not have an implied covenant of quiet enjoyment when you have an express covenant of quiet enjoyment in the contract, and in the case law, it looks like those two, that principle of law is invoked when the two are contrary to one another or provide differing rights. And so that's my question. If the implied covenant of quiet enjoyment here and the express covenant of quiet enjoyment in the contract are the same, does it matter how it was submitted?
I would argue no. I don't see that there's a difference. It looks to me like it was like they had an express covenant of quiet enjoyment. which would, well, I guess in the big scheme of maneuver, what would happen would be where an implied covenant would come up would possibly be if you did not have a contract and you had something along the lines and you were relying upon, say, maybe a claim for quantum merit, and then you would argue something along those lines. But I don't think you'd not be able to recover attorney's fees because you would already have it deemed that you didn't have a contract. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
Part of this express and implied, one of the things that they rely upon, I went in and looked, they were talking about setting up a situation where the they argued, and one of the objections, the objection that they really had at trial regarding the question number one that was submitted was, first, was no evidence, and then secondly, what they were arguing was the language. They wanted the language for a constructive eviction. And as I pointed out in my brief, constructive eviction, and I cited the case law, constructive eviction is typically a defense. And in their reply brief, they mentioned two cases. The two cases that they mentioned were Gonbari versus Tran, which is an unpublished opinion out of Beaumont. And in that actual opinion that they cite in their reply brief to rebut the argument that I had in the appellee's brief, in footnote one, they actually reference exactly what I'm talking about. This is a defensive claim. Also, in that particular case, it was an injunctive relief case, and the contract that did not have an express warranty in it or an express covenant of quiet enjoyment, which they did not allow, and the person was suing based upon breach of contract primarily for a competition clause, and there was no competition clause in that case. The second case they cite is 2616 South Loop LLC versus Health Source Home Care. They say that that case also stands for that same proposition. If you read the case where they cite on this issue, the reason they throw it out is because there's no evidence of a contract. They basically said South Loop was not part of a contract. In both of these cases, the contracts were thrown out, and the court ruled, and it was all in dicta. They're just generally referring to a case law. If you go back and you actually look at the, I read all these cases. When you go back and you look at these cases, there's one case, and it's the case that they rely upon very heavily. That is the case where they go in and they are talking about, it's the first case that cites the elements for a constructive eviction and applies it to a case of breach of quiet enjoyment. And they cite a case which does not stand for that proposition that they cite in that ruling. All the other cases, when you go and you start looking at these case law, and when you go and look at the case law, it makes sense. And I even put in there, the way they differentiate this on, the way they differentiate it is the reason you have to abandon the property, and that's an element, is because it terminates the tenant's obligation to pay rent. So if you do not get out, they do not want to have an unjust enrichment situation occur where a tenant is being able to enjoy a piece of property without having to pay rent, and that's what it's doing. And it makes sense. Otherwise, it would actually make no sense whatsoever that an element would be to you have to vacate in order to get the landlord to obey the terms of the lease. That doesn't really make sense at all, unless you put it in the proper fact pattern. And we don't have those facts in this particular matter. The points that they brought up were both legal and factual sufficiency on these issues. On the legal and factual sufficiency, as far as factual sufficiency, the contract came in without objection. The record itself, the prior court's rulings, the testimony that came in at trial, all these things show that there was factual sufficiency. Most of this was unrebutted. Same with the appellant's other arguments. Most of these things came in without objection, or if they were objected to, they allowed evidence in without objection at a later point. I'm running out of time, but going immediately to the issue of damages, same exact situation. What occurred was Lana Ralston testified, Exhibit 20 came in. Exhibit 20 was detailed profit and loss statements or financial statements that were submitted, and those financial statements were used. They came in without objection, and the jury is the one who gets to weigh credibility and weight. And it was unrefuted. Most of this stuff was not rebutted at all. Same way with the attorney's fees. It was not brought up, but it was brought up in the brief. They're talking about segregation. Once again, there was no cross-examination regarding the segregation. There was no rebuttal evidence from their expert. The only thing that's in the record that establishes each of these claims is the testimony of the witnesses of DFW Supergroup.
But wasn't there a point, on attorney fees related to the amount of time that passed throughout the litigation, I guess before they were brought in, and was relative only to the claims between DFW and Dr. Burstford?
Yes, Your Honor. And the testimony of DFW's expert, he actually said that they had segregated those fees, and that was unrebutted. And I see I'm out of time.
I'd like to ask a question before you sit down.
Yes, Your Honor.
About the summary judgment, can you clarify what was granted and what was denied?
Well, Your Honor, pretty much most of the claims were granted, and I actually put the exact language in the order just on this point, because it says it is further ordered, and what I'm quoting from is the order granting partial summary judgment from the court, and it said, and the key part is on page 2 of that order. It says, it is further ordered that as to plaintiff's remaining claims against the hospital, which are DFW2 lease claims for indemnification and breach of quiet enjoyment for damages arising out of the hospital providing Dr. Burstford with a key, the court denies summary judgment. And at that time, the motion for summary judgment can only be on claims that exist. In the pleadings, there is no claim for an implied covenant. Same way with the time of trial. There's no pleading to support an implied covenant. Did I answer your question, Your
Honor? Yes, you did. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Toobs.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Hood, rebuttal.
Just a couple points in rebuttal. Counsel for DFW just represented that there's no pleading in the petition for breach of an implied covenant of quiet enjoyment. That's the argument we made at trial, and the judge said that he didn't see a difference between the two, and he was going to allow DFW to proceed to the jury with a breach of implied covenant of quiet enjoyment. It was DFW who said, you didn't rule on our implied covenant claim in our petition. So it's very different than the case now being presented to you. But at trial, DFW said, Your Honor, we understand you're having some concern about your summary judgment because the court did say that it was not a breach of the lease to provide the key. And then the judge said, well, I've got this indemnification and covenant of quiet enjoyment, and I believe the court said, you know, I'm having problems reconciling this, and it was DFW that stood up and said, we have a claim for breach of the implied covenant, and you haven't ruled on that. And the judge said, that's what you can take to the jury. So that's what happened at the trial court.
How are the warranties any different, or the covenants any different?
I was going to address that. I believe there is a difference. Your Honor, because had the jury been asked to rule on the express covenant, then I believe what would have happened is that the jury charge would have referenced the lease, would have referenced paragraph 21.8, and would have used the language from 21.8 to see if there had been a breach of that. And that's not what DFW presented. That was a concern, is that they presented an implied covenant. They did not use the same language. Now, what does that mean? Well, when you're going under common law, you're bringing in the common law definition of implied covenant and all of what common law has determined makes for a breach of the implied covenant. We believe that in this particular situation, you either had to have abandonment, actual eviction, or constructive eviction. And DFW went with the constructive eviction. Those bring in elements of certain claims. We believe that there's a difference between the implied and the express, because the express would be the language of the contract, and the common law implied brings in the case law that establishes the criteria.
The language of the contract is almost identical to the instruction or the predicate statement in question number one.
Well, it is similar. I don't believe it's identical, because the lease was not used as the model.
The question says there is an implied covenant in favor of the tenant that the tenant will have peaceful and quiet enjoyment of the premises for the term of the lease, which also the word lease makes it sound like it's contractual. And then 21.8 says landlord shall warrant, and if I can read this small print, defend tenant in the quiet enjoyment and possession of the premises throughout the term, subject to the terms, conditions, limitations set forth in the lease. So they're almost identical. And my question is, can you tell me how paragraph 21.8 provides any different rights to either party than the implied covenant?
And my response is they are very similar. Question number one, referring to term of the lease, there are leases that don't have an express covenant. So you could have a lease and have an implied covenant. They're not mutually exclusive. And I will say that I believe there's a difference under the case law, because the implied covenant brings in the common law elements that are not set forth in the express. I believe that's why you have Texas law that says if you have an express covenant, you can't try to bring in an implied covenant, and I don't believe that the test is how different it is. The test is you don't have implied covenants when you have an express that address that.
Looking at the case law, to me it looks like that the reason for that proposition of law that the express and the implied cannot coexist is because typically in the case law discussing them, they're different. And so clearly, if you have a contractual provision governing anything, it trumps common law governing anything. But if they're not different, why would that premise of law apply?
Well, I think most of the time when you see that conflict, it will be because there are differences between the express and the implied. But I still think the general rule is, so that you don't get into that whole analysis of how it differs, the general rule is we don't imply something if it's express.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hood.
Thank you,
Mr. Tubbs. We appreciate your arguments today, and all of your briefing is greatly appreciated. Your case is submitted, and you all are excused.